Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Engineering America, The Life and Times of John A. Roebling, by Richard Haw, narrated by Rick Adamson. Publisher's note: this audiobook refers to figures included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Whenever necessity calls for new works of art, new expedients will be discovered, adapted to the occasion. It will no longer suit the spirit of the present age to pronounce an undertaking impracticable. Nothing is impracticable which is within the scope of natural laws. John A. Roebling, 1852. Introduction. Fitting oneself to the new world. On May 23, 1831, the transatlantic packet boat Auguste Edouard sailed up the Weser River, edged past Bremerhaven, and glided out into the North Sea. On board were a random collection of German tradesmen, watchmakers, cobblers, farmers, tanners. Some were intellectuals, many were dreamers. All were bound for a new life in the new world. Most of the travelers belonged to the Mühlhausen Emigration Society and hoped to set up camp somewhere in the United States. Their leader was a 24-year-old construction site supervisor who failed to finish university, had been unemployed for almost 3 years, and had never previously traveled more than a couple of hundred miles from the town of his birth. His name was Johann August Roebling. While skirting the length of the Frisian Islands, Johann busied himself finding his sea legs and helping to get everyone else settled. When he wasn't bent over the ship's railing dealing with a violent bout of seasickness or fussing around asking countless questions, he was busy recording his thoughts and impressions in his diary. Mostly, he was curious and excited, but as the Auguste Edouard left the English Channel and sailed out into the Atlantic, Johann's mood turned plaintive. As we see the last of the shores of Europe vanish from our sight, we separate ourselves at a single stroke from the old world, from all that is known and familiar. Fortunately, the long voyage across the great ocean provides time and leisure enough to prepare oneself mentally for the rupture. Out on the ocean, everything moves more freely, and the sight of the open, wide sea serves altogether to arouse the feeling of personal freedom and natural independence in every breast. All impressions which America will make upon us, Johann reasoned, will in reality be new, no matter how familiar we may already have made ourselves with the new continent. Upon arrival, the colonists would discover an unfamiliar national character and an entirely new set of political institutions. It would be easy to accept much that is good and honorable, but there would also be much that will appear offensive to us, and there will be much which concerns the people, its disposition, and its character, which we cannot approve. Only the future can teach us to what degree the picture we have sketched of the United States agrees with the reality, Johann reflected. But in the meantime, they must prepare themselves. Their most important effort would consist in shaking off the old European prejudices and fitting oneself to the new world. After all, every people demands of a foreigner that he will assimilate himself to his environment as soon as possible. Johann's message was simple, both to himself and to his fellow emigrants: cast off the old and embrace the new. This was no idle cliché, but a heartfelt admonition he had struggled with his entire life. Johann's first 24 years were defined by a personal battle, a contest between the staid influence of place and the dynamic context of historical change. The place was Johann's hometown of Mühlhausen, a sleepy, walled town, medieval in both look and feel, where his relatives were elder statesmen, and where nothing much had happened in quite some time, which was how the townsfolk liked it. Established tradition ruled in Mulhausen, and any change was viewed with skepticism at best, hostility almost always. Unfortunately for Mulhausers, by the time the 19th century rolled around and Johann appeared on the scene, the forces of modernity, social, political, industrial, had been unleashed and were gathering steam. The Industrial Revolution recast how people understood their place in the landscape. The French Revolution reshaped how people understood their relation to each other and to their nations. Everything Johann experienced as a child and young adult flowed directly from one of these two events, despite the heavy confining influence of Mulhausen. Johann spent his youth and early manhood in a world clinging desperately to the past while simultaneously hurtling pell-mell into an uncertain future. His burden was to choose fidelity to family, home, and the past, or to the coming world, to stay and settle, or to jump into modernity's rising vortex. Johann leapt, committing himself to a lifelong act of creation and a new anglicized name, John Roebling. He would take his newfound personal freedom and natural independence and go looking. He would embrace new ideas, unearth new laws, and build new things. Investigation, invention, ambition, and growth became his watchwords and guiding principles. But they came with a deep-rooted contradiction. John's desire for freedom coexisted with a lifelong need for order and control. As a child of Napoleonic Europe, he longed for an end to discord and disarray. As a student in Berlin, he yearned to escape from the repressive crackdowns that followed in the little corporal's wake. As an engineer, he dreamed of visionary new structures rooted in the minutiae of technical precision. As a new American, he wished for the liberty of individualism amid the structure of a well-planned community. As a keen thinker and philosopher, he craved a precise understanding of the world that rejected religious traditions and embraced new ideas. Such were the constants and the contradictions in his life. John's mind and character were seldom in balance and at rest, even while he sought harmony above all things, which is what led him to the Auguste Edouard and the great expanse of the Atlantic Ocean. John's life in Prussia had been formative. After a youth spent amid the chaos and destruction of the Napoleonic Wars and the social control that followed in their wake, John earned a seat at the prestigious National Building Academy in Berlin, where he heard G.W.F. Hegel lecture on logic, experienced the rising might and the promise of the Industrial Revolution, and was introduced to the fledgling science of suspension bridges. He became enthralled by all three. After several years building roads in Westphalia and kicking about his hometown, he boarded the Auguste Edouard, hoping to establish a communal settlement in America along principles he had worked out and published with his friend and fellow technological visionary, John Etzler. He succeeded only in establishing Saxonburg, Pennsylvania, a rather humdrum little village. Returning to engineering, the one thing he was good at, John worked on a variety of internal improvements projects, designing canals, surveying railroad routes, designing dams and locomotives. In 1841, he hit on the idea of making rope out of spiraled wire, a notion that made his fortune. John worked furiously throughout the 1840s, bursting into the consciousness of the world's engineering community with a series of daring plans and proposals, even while his achievements were rather more modest, three suspension aqueducts and a single suspension bridge. During the same time, he also built up his wire rope works into a large national industry, so much so that by the end of the decade, he was forced to move his entire operation east. He spent the next two decades only somewhat less furiously realizing all the plans and ideas he had proposed and establishing himself as America's preeminent bridge builder. He built the world's first functioning railroad suspension bridge over the Niagara Falls Gorge and the first structure to link a northern state with a southern one after the Civil War, the Covington and Cincinnati Suspension Bridge. In 1867, he was awarded the contract to build a massive 1,600-foot span over the East River between the independent cities of New York and Brooklyn, a project he had actively lobbied for since 1857. On the verge of commencing his dream project, Roebling suffered a bizarre accident at the bridge site. He was soon diagnosed with tetanus, and he died in agony on July 22, 1869, several months before construction of his dream bridge had even begun. Like his finest creations, John was held together by the delicate balance of countervailing forces. On the surface, he led an exemplary public life, and his accomplishments were legion. As an immigrant, community builder, manufacturer, and employer, he was admired and respected. As an inventor and engineer, his works profoundly altered the physical landscape of America. John believed in the moral application of science and technology, that great works of connection, bridges, railroads, the Atlantic cable, could help bring people together, erase divisions, heal wounds, and bring about a fairer and more equal society. He was deeply committed to the creation of a more perfect union, forged from the raw materials of the continent. He was a fervent abolitionist, a deep and voracious reader of philosophy, a proficient linguist, and an accomplished musician. Yet John's public persona, engaged, calm, rational, and specific, was offset by private mania. Behind closed doors, he was intense, fierce, and often irrational. Oddly, for a technical genius, John's understanding of the natural world bordered on the occult, and his opinions about medicine are best described as medieval. For a man of science and great self-certainty, he was also remarkably quick to seize on fads and foolish trends. He believed not just in science, but also in the spirit world, in wrapping himself in a wet sheet at night, and in chewing charcoal on a daily basis. The two poles of Roebling's personality played out most poignantly in his relationship with his first and most burdened son. Washington Roebling was awed and inspired by his father. Privately, he feared him and was haunted by their relationship. "Roebling was a great man," Washington once remarked, "but there was something of the tiger about him." John was a complex, deeply divided, yet undoubtedly influential figure, one of the foremost engineers in a century defined by engineering. And his biography illuminates not only his works, but also the world of 19th-century America. Yet while John's engineering feats are well known, the man himself is not. For alongside the drama of large-scale construction lies an equally rich drama of intellectual and social development and crisis, one that mirrored and reflected the great forces, trials, and failures of the American 19th century. Unfortunately, John has proved a hard man to know. Many of the details of John's life were invented or enhanced in the late 19th and early 20th centuries by John's descendants in an effort to sanctify and sanitize his image, most of which has simply been repeated in books and articles over the years. Few people have gone to the archives to seek him out, ensuring that the story of John's story has remained thin. In 1972, while compiling the bibliography for The Great Bridge, David McCullough noted that there was no first-rate biography of John. Nothing in the intervening time has altered this fact. Engineering America is a book about one man's struggle to define himself, to learn, adapt, and change, to keep moving in new and unfamiliar directions, and to achieve independence even as he clung to his own fixed ideas and opinions. It is about how Johann August Roebling, the third child of a provincial Prussian tobacconist, became John A. Roebling, C.E., world-renowned American engineer, and wealthy manufacturer. It is also the story of how a liberty-loving Democrat became first a corporate Whig and then an entrenched Republican. More broadly, this is a book about the 19th century, about Jacksonian and pre-Civil War America, about the market, transportation, and communications revolutions, about shifting notions of freedom and liberty, slavery and dependence, politics and philosophy, immigration and community, science and superstition, about a nation's passage from individualism to incorporation. And it is about one man's place within it all, as a witness, a participant, and a driving force. John's life naturally breaks down into three parts, reflected in the structure of this book: Novice, 1806 to 1831, Apprentice, 1831 to 1847, and Master, 1848 to 1869. The years 1831 and 1846 were the two great linchpins in John's life, the years in which he stopped being an uncertain, struggling young man striving to find an identity and a career, and started being an established engineer and manufacturer, confident in his abilities and his place in the world. The year 1831 was one of profound decision and tremendous upheaval for John. The year 1846 was one of Herculean effort, great vision, and creative achievement. He built his second acclaimed suspension bridge, secured the long-term viability of his wire rope business, toured New York for the first time, and drew up plans for several huge new bridges. Before the year was out, he had also conceived an audacious plan to build a massive Y-shaped bridge to stretch out from the point of Pittsburgh and branch off to either side of the Ohio River. In 1846 and 47, Roebling set the goals for much of the rest of his life, and he spent his remaining years fulfilling them. From 1832 until 1847, Roebling was a learner and an apprentice, a man in the making in an era and a country that were constantly making and remaking themselves. From 1848 through to his death in 1869, Roebling was a master, an acknowledged expert, and an unbending authority, a man in full. Part 1. Novice, 1806 to 1831. Chapter 1. In Napoleon's Shadow, 1806 to 1824. All that is known about Johann Roebling's hometown of Mühlhausen before 967 is its name: Mühle, mill, Hausen, home, meaning place of watermills, situated on the banks of the Unstrut River in Thuringia, in what is now the geographical center of Germany. Mühlhausen was granted free imperial city status in 1251 and subsequently became a major center for textile production, alongside tanning and dyeing, brewing, ironmongery, and other manufactories. By the end of the 15th century, it was part of the commercially powerful Hanseatic League and boasted a population of almost 10,000, making it one of the largest and most prosperous towns in the German-speaking world. Then its luck ran out. By the close of the late Middle Ages, Mühlhausen had declined into a backwater. Fueled by favorable legislation and royal patronage, the rise of nearby Leipzig as a major trading center helped erode Mühlhausen's influence, yet worse was to come. In 1524, the radical Christian reformer Thomas Müntzer arrived in Mühlhausen and in 10 months managed to wreak havoc on the town, steering Mühlhausen into the teeth of the German Peasants' War. On May 15, 1525, Müntzer led 8,000 farmers into the Battle of Frankenhausen and was routed. 2 days later, he was beheaded in Mühlhausen, and his decapitated body displayed outside the town gates. Müntzer lived on as a Marxist icon, the hero of Friedrich Engels's The Peasant War in Germany, and the face that graced the East German 5-mark note. Mühlhausen fared less well. Forced into heavy reparation payments, it was stripped of its free imperial status and placed under the control of Saxony and Hesse. Mühlhausen regained its imperial status in 1548, but never its former trading might. It suffered terribly through the devastation and chaos of the 30 Years' War. Many of its leading residents left town for good, while others were conscripted, went to war, and never came back. By the close of the conflict, the town's population was half what it had been 50 years earlier. In the aftermath, Mühlhausen rolled on in relative peace, neither prosperous nor destitute. Johann Sebastian Bach brought some brief fame to town in 1707 when he took a job there as an organist, but a year later he left for a better-paying job and much better choir in Weimar. In 1670, the first Roebling, Hans Jacobus, arrived in Mühlhausen from nearby Bad Tennstedt and did pretty well for himself. By 1756, his grandson, Hermann Christian Roebling, had made enough money to purchase a large house in the center of town and achieved sufficient local standing to get elected to the town council. Hermann's eldest son, Heinrich Wilhelm, went into business as a wholesale merchant and accumulated a large fortune. Known as the Rich Roebling, he died in 1841. Hermann's second son, Ernst Adolf, became president of the Mühlhausen Clothmakers and Serge Makers Guild, and his third, Christoph Polycarpus, contributed little of lasting importance to the world, apart from fathering Johann. Polycarp Roebling was a popular figure in Mühlhausen. He owned a tobacco shop in the center of town and lived comfortably in the house bought by his father. He appears to have been a jovial, easygoing man with steady habits and an active imagination, yet with neither ambition nor a sense of adventure. According to his grandson, Polycarp spent much of his time telling tall tales of faraway places at his shop or the local pub, despite never having left the town of his birth. In 1798, he married Friederike Dorothea Müller, and together they had 5 children during the next 8 years, 4 of whom survived into adulthood. Their first child, Hermann Christian, born in 1800, inherited Polycarp's tobacco business and sense of adventure. He never left Mühlhausen either and died in 1859. A daughter died in infancy in 1801, and another arrived the following year. Friederike Amalie, known as Malchen, married Karl August Meissner, a prominent local merchant, and eventually immigrated to the United States in 1852 after her husband's death. A second son, Friedrich Karl, was born in 1804. Karl also ended up traveling to America with his younger brother in 1831. The family was completed with the birth of Johann August on June 12, 1806. The town in which Johann was born was dominated by its defensive fortifications and by its religious devotion. In the 12th century, Mühlhausen built a thick stone wall in an effort to keep out roving marauders and safeguard its growing prosperity. These new defenses created a sense of security, stability, and safety, as well as an insular feeling of encasement, as if the town had walled itself in, not others out. Rising up above the town's massive fortifications were the spires and steeples of Mühlhausen's numerous churches and chapels. Despite covering barely a square mile, Mühlhausen was home to over 13 different houses of worship. The upper town, Oberstadt, was dominated by St. Mary's, Mühlhausen's largest house of worship, the preferred house of prayer of the town's civic leadership. The town's lower half, Unterstadt, was dominated by St. Blasius, the preferred church of the Roebling family, close by on Erfurter Straße. Mühlhausen was also home to a modest Jewish population that appears to have existed since at least 1380, when the town's first synagogue was built. The town hall, Rathaus, stood as a meeting place in the heart of the town's old quarter. Farmers from the surrounding area assembled at the town market to sell their wares and blow off a little steam. The area was notoriously rowdy, and somewhat unfortunately, positioned directly opposite the town's main school, which Johann and his brothers attended. The market was also the town's main social and commercial hub, a bustling place from dawn to dusk, especially during the high summer harvest months. While the churches were Gothic, most of the homes and houses were half-timbered or Baroque, with steep red-tiled gable roofs and upper stories that overhung Mulhausen's narrow, ramshackle streets. Built in 1587, Johann's family home was three stories, built of stone, with French dormer windows and a large round arch doorway. The Mulhausen Gymnasium was only a few hundred yards away, as was Polycarp's tobacco shop, meaning the family could live their entire lives without traveling more than a few blocks in any direction. The Roeblings woke each morning to the peal of St. Blasius's huge church bells, the sound of the church's massive organ, the same one that Bach played a century before, filled the Roebling home with melodious sound. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, Johann grew up with a great love of music. Organized religion appealed to him much less, although, like the rest of the family, he dutifully attended St. Blasius's every Sunday. Sealed off from the world behind its great stone walls, Mulhausen stood as a bucolic, unchanging monument to the Middle Ages and the heavy, dead weight of history. Johann only managed to enjoy about 4 months of quiet and sleepy provinciality, however, before the gates to his city were forced open and his world overrun. By mid-October 1806, the Roeblings were residents of an occupied town, and by the end of the month, subjects of a conquered country. Johann spent his first 7 years in the middle of the largest and most destructive war the world had yet seen, all of which came as a great surprise to the residents of Mulhausen. Mulhausen's first rude awakening occurred on April 17, 1803, in consequence of a war fought 6 years earlier and over 370 miles away, about which the Roeblings knew absolutely nothing, Mulhausen rather inexplicably lost its free imperial city status and passed into the hands of Prussia. The Peace of Campo Formio, signed on October 1797, acknowledged French victories over Austria in northern Italy and French acquisitions in the German Rhineland, and after 6 years of territorial bargaining, compensated Austria and Prussia for their losses in the west with gains in the east. Suddenly, the fate of Mulhausen and the Roebling family was firmly and dangerously tied to that of Prussia. Since 1792, Prussia had been alternately at war with the French, at peace, or simply afraid to make a decision either way. Most often, Prussia tried to preserve some neutrality, although, as the philosopher Gottfried Leibniz once observed, Prussian neutrality is rather like someone who lives in the middle of a house and is smoked out from below and drenched with urine from above. By trying to keep everyone happy, the Prussian leadership pleased no one. Worse yet, they vacillated, forming and then forsaking alliances with all the major powers. By the time Johann was born, Prussia had more or less run out of options. The little corporal was coming, ready or not. One can only imagine how the happy-go-lucky Polycarp felt in June 1806 as his final son entered the world. Mulhausers were naturally inward-looking, somewhat complacent people, yet they must have caught an inkling of the changes underway all over Europe. Paris was a world away in late 18th century terms, but there was no ignoring the social and political ramifications of the French Revolution, especially once the internal struggle morphed into a series of external wars and the tremors of social revolution became the concrete rumblings of an advancing army. Compared to Napoleon's Grande Armée, The Prussia military was laughably outmoded in tactics and materiel. Nevertheless, they mobilized secretly in August 1806 and sent an ultimatum.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?